Okay. So you'll see plenty of me today. The topic of the first two lectures is really going to be to look at cosmological perturbations. So on Saturday, we saw how the ekpyrotic phase manages to classically flatten the universe to a very high degree, and thereby to solve the flatness problem, for example. Now we're going to add quantum fluctuations on top of this. And this story is actually slightly more subtle than one might think at first. So that's why this lecture here is called Cosmological Perturbations First Attempt, because this is going to require a bit more work to get to the final answer. Now, let me just make some very general remarks first. So, as I said, we're going to add quantum fluctuations here on top of the classical background evolution. The second one is that the way one generates perturbations in cosmology is that you have quantum fluctuations, but typically quantum fluctuations average to zero and you don't notice them. For example, now in this room, we don't notice them. Now, in cosmology, you have a horizon that's varying over time. And in fact, it turns out that you can have cosmological perturbations. And if they're well within the horizon, they just oscillate and nothing much happens. However, what happens here in the ekpyrotic case is that the horizon shrinks very fast. So the horizon actually goes roughly as 1/Hubble parameter. And so actually it goes roughly proportionally to t. So as t goes to zero, the horizon shrinks to zero as well. So if you have you have time moving up, space this way. For a given perturbation, the horizon surrounding that perturbation shrinks away. So here it oscillates, but here it starts going out of causal contact with itself. I mean, you have an oscillation, but the region that's in causal contact is starting to become very small. So at some point, in some sense, the perturbation doesn't notice anymore that it is a perturbation. So the field value changes a bit, but it doesn't know. It just thinks that that's its normal value because it doesn't realize anymore what's happening in the surroundings. And that, in that sense, then this perturbation becomes a classical perturbation. It's just a very rough argument, but one can do this more precisely in the calculations, and we'll do that later on. So again, just to contrast with inflation, inflation is in some sense, well, sort of the dual picture of this. What happens for inflation is that the horizon turns out to be constant. However, the modes themselves get stretched. So this is because in the ekpyrotic case, we had the scale factor being roughly constant and h going as 1/t. And for inflation, we have h roughly constant and a growing exponentially. The end result is basically the same. You have quantum fluctuations which are within the horizon initially and then go outside of the horizon and turn into classical perturbations. The other thing is that in the ekpyrotic case, you generate these perturbations before the Big Bang. And these are the perturbations that will later on lead to the density fluctuations and the temperature fluctuations in the CMB. And so, in fact, you generate sort of the seeds for the large-scale structure of the universe in the time before the Big Bang. In that sense, the structure we see today would be a remnant of what was set up at the time, you know, in the previous era. So, since the scale factor is roughly constant, in the ekpyrotic case, there is a very simple limit one can look at, just sort of as a toy model first. This is to take the single field case, but to ignore gravity completely. So we're only going to look at the scalar field and the perturbation of the scalar field, but not include metric perturbations also. So we actually take the limit where the background is exactly constant and we turn off the gravitational fluctuations too. This is just useful to see roughly how this calculation works. So the action is very simple. It's just a scalar field. In the ekpyrotic potential. Notice the plus sign here, that's because normally you would have minus V. The potential is negative, so it's plus. Then we're going to just expand the field phi in terms of a background evolution, which depends only on time, plus a fluctuation delta phi, which depends on time and spatial coordinates. Then the equation of motion for this field is very simple. It's delta phi double dot minus delta squared phi, nabla squared phi, plus the second derivative of v with respect to phi. Sorry, this should be delta phi. And the background evolution is just the scaling solution that we had in the last lecture, but phi goes logarithmically, but the scale factor actually takes the limit where A doesn't just shrink slowly, but actually becomes constant. So we need to know what V comma phi phi is. Well, you can see it's equal to C squared V, and from I had a relation in the last lecture that V is minus 1 over epsilon T squared. Epsilon is related to C directly, and so this is, in fact, just minus 2 over T squared. So now we're going to go to do a Fourier transformation, go to momentum space, and in order to do that, we just expand the field in terms of A sub k. This is, chi sub k is a function of time. E to the I k dot x in the usual way, and then plus the Hermitian conjugate. So in fact, this A k, well, the idea is to look at the quantum fluctuations. In order to do that, we're just going to do canonical quantization, where we set A to being the annihilation operator. Okay, so A is the annihilation operator. And this operator, as usual, defines the vacuum. Of the theory. And these are then, chi here corresponds to the positive frequency. Mode function. And then there'll be a Hermitian conjugate, which will be the creation, which will involve the creation operator and the negative frequency functions. Okay, so there's the, and then we impose the usual commutation relations. So A commutes with A dagger commutes with A dagger. But the interesting relation is the one between A and A dagger. Which is given by a delta function, right? So if the moment, if K and K prime, the two momenta are equal, this commutator is non-trivial. Okay. So one can also re-express this directly in terms of the field. So in fact, this canonical quantization is in the same way. You can just say, well, you take, you impose the, I'm sorry. As you usually do in quantum field theory, you impose these commutation relations on equal time slices, right? So you can express this in terms of the field phi at time t and x, but you have to compare with the field at time t and different spatial location. Again, so this commutator vanishes. The momentum, since this is just a normal canonically normalized kinetic term, in fact, the momentum that's conjugate to phi is just phi dot. Right, so the same goes for phi dot. And then the interesting relation is the one between phi and phi dot. So this would be in normal space, and this would be in Fourier space. Just writing this, well, there's actually no need to write both of these, but I'm just writing them for completeness. Okay, so then actually this mode function chi obeys just the classical equation of motion. This equation here. Which reads delta chi double dot plus k squared delta chi. So the Navla squared acts on the e to the I k dot x in the Fourier expansion and turns into a k squared. Yes.
So chi and delta chi squared.
Oh, sorry. I could just. Oh, yeah. I'll shift it.
Okay. Hi.
Minus 2 over t squared chi. So k equals 0. So this is the equation for small fluctuations away from the background. Now, there's two solutions to this. One is given by e to the minus ikt times 1 minus I over kt. And And the second one is e to the plus I kt over 1 plus I over kt. So the way to fix what solution we want to look at is to impose boundary conditions. So at early times, we know that the modes are well within the horizon. The modes are just, they just feel like they're in normal Minkowski space. So what we want to have this solution approaching just a normal Minkowski vacuum at early times. Okay, so the standard Minkowski, so as t goes to minus infinity, what we want is to get the Minkowski vacuum, which is 1 over root 2k e to the minus I kt. So we know that we have to take the solution proportional to this one here. Okay, so the solution is actually chi k, chi sub k is 1 over root 2k e to the minus I kt, 1 minus I over kt. And this is often called the Bunch-Davies vacuum. So you can see that as t goes to zero, so at late times, in fact, we have that the absolute the modulus of chi goes to just minus 1 over root 2 k to the 3/2 t. There's the minus sign because time is negative. Right, I'm still using the same coordinate system where the Big Bang is at t equals zero, and then so for the ekpyrotic phase, which happens before, time is negative, and then the expanding phase of the universe afterwards has time positive. And this scaling with k turns out to be very important, actually. But so we'll turn to that in a second. So I just wanted to say something about how usually one can understand that these modes turn into classical perturbations. So I've used natural units up to now, where I set h bar equal to zero. So for this, it's more transparent to restore h bar just momentarily. So if we keep h bar, then we would have had that the commutator between phi and phi dot would have been equal to I h bar delta of x minus x prime. Okay, and then in that case, the solution chi k, because this commutator actually determines the normalization of the solution. So here, what we found was what the solution has to be proportional to, but nothing fixes the normalization of chi. The easiest way, and also again, what we really want is just at early times we want the vacuum to be proportional to this, but this doesn't fix the exact constant of proportionality. That's fixed by plugging the solution back into this commutator for phi and phi dot. Sure.
When we wrote down the action, did we assume that it's already Minkowski spacetime?
That it's what? Sorry.
Minkowski spacetime.
Yes.
So, but you said like we want the perturbation in Minkowski spacetime. So, why we did obtain this the second solution? So, if it is the solution for the Minkowski spacetime as well.
So well, it's not. It's well. It's just. It's a scalar field with a potential, right? So,
yes. But
in other words, at very early times, you can say that the scalar field doesn't feel the potential.
Yes.
So what you want is the solution for just a free scalar field in Minkowski space. That's more probably more precise to say. Mm-hmm. At early times, you just want the vacuum corresponding to a free scalar in Minkowski space. At late times, the potential becomes more and more important, and it has the effect of giving you this form here. Right, so you switch asymptotically from at early times you have this solution, and at late times you have this one. But this is due to the potential, to the ecbotic potential. This is something that turns out to be generally true, that you want this vacuum for free scalar field in Minkowski space at early times, even when you include gravity, because the modes are because the horizon is very large at early times, so the modes don't really feel any curvature of space or so. So they're almost in Minkowski space. The further back in time you go, the more closely to Minkowski space you are. So this is actually, that turns out to be something that we want to impose even when we include gravity. So if we...
he goes to zero, then in what sense this is a perturbation?
Well, that's a formal limit. The potential doesn't go all the way to zero. So, as I said in the last lecture, the potential goes up to a certain minimum scale, and then it turns off. So we want the ecbotic potential to look something like, it's a steeply falling potential, but at some point it will just come back up. And then the potential becomes unimportant. The thing is, the background solution also formally diverges as t goes to zero. Because, for example, you have phi dot going as 1 over t.
So
what you should, in order to check with whether this is valid in perturbation theory or not, you need to find a gauge where, you need to compare it to the background evolution. Now, you can do this, you have to... Usually you have to use synchronous gauge to do this, to see this properly. But this is something you can check if you want. Compared to the classical solution, you're not diverging away from the classical. You still have small perturbation around the classical solution. It's just that both the classical, formally, the classical and the perturbation both diverge. So if we kept h-bar, we would have found that chi k is equal to the square root of h-bar over 2k times the e to the minus I kt, 1 minus I over kt. So you can see that phi dot, so one of these sides of this commutator is phi phi dot minus phi dot phi. So phi phi dot is roughly the order of h bar over kt cubed. Okay, so that's the left-hand side of this commutator. And the right-hand side is like h bar. So in fact, typically when kt becomes smaller than 1, what the phrase people use usually is that modes go out of the modes exit the horizon, right? That's or that the perturbations are super horizon perturbations or something like this. And then in that case, you can see that the left-hand side becomes much bigger than the right-hand side, right? So as t goes to zero. And so, in fact, you can neglect this, the fact that phi and phi dot don't commute. So in other words, as time goes to zero, you don't see the, you can for practical, well, you don't see the quantum nature anymore. Yes.
You said that phi bar itself is diverging in the logarithm of theta.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
What was the behavior of a phi bar in the background solution?
It just goes as log t.
Log t. Log t.
Phi bar goes as something like log minus t.
Yes, right.
I don't know the exact coefficient now.
So when t goes to zero, and perturbation is a running cluster to the infinity, then the background is set, right?
Well, I guess you really have to look at sort of, you have to remember that I'm taking a limit here, which is a bit of an artificial limit because I'm turning off gravity. So if you include gravity, you should really include gravity, do this with gravity. We're going to do that in a second. But and then you have to look at invariants. You can't just look at phi, but at the evolution of phi, you have to look at sort of curvature invariants and things like this, or the energy density. So phi dot squared goes as 1 over t squared. So in that sense, you still have the perturbation. Okay, so that was just an aside. Of course, we have the solution, but what we want to do is relate this to sort of standard observables. Now, from the expansion, just in terms of creation and annihilation operators, it's very easy to see, for example, that the average fluctuation just that the fluctuations just average out to zero. But the important quantity is in fact the variance. Right? So the mean is zero, but the variance, which is the expectation value of delta phi squared, this is the in fact the important quantity. So we write this as the integral of dk over k of delta phi, delta sub phi squared of k. Okay, and then, so this is the variance. And in fact, it's useful to parameterize it. In terms of some reference scale, so you pick a certain scale, k naught, and then it's usually written as the variance at that scale times this power law factor, k over k naught to the power ns minus 1. Okay, so this is a reference scale. And n sub s is called the spectral index. In fact, this is the scalar spectral index. The spectral index for tensor perturbations is defined slightly differently. Inconveniently so, but. Okay, so what, so here for this for the solution we just had here, chi,
if you just perform this integral, well, let's see. Let's just do it. Okay, so the expectation value of delta phi squared is given by the integral over all Fourier modes. And then it's just chi chi star. This you can easily verify. And then, so this is equal to this D3K, we can write it as 4 pi squared. 4 pi k squared dk. So over 2 pi cubed. Then we can just plug this in. 1 over 2 k cubed t squared. And so you can see that the variance here, delta phi squared, delta sub phi squared of k, is just equal to 1 over 4 pi squared t squared. And the important thing is that this is independent of k. And that's why it's called a scale invariant spectrum. So from the definition here, if delta phi doesn't depend on k, you can see that what this means is that in each logarithmic interval of k, you have the same power. Right, so you have something which you can just, if you have a perturbation which has this kind of property, you can just blow up the whole thing or shrink it. It always looks the same. That's what it means. So in other words, we have n sub s equals 1. Now, actually, people often use something called a power spectrum, which is directly related to this variance. But people use, there's lots of different definitions for the power spectrum. And it depends on whether, so for example, also people who look at the large scale structure of the universe often use a different definition than people who look at the early universe. So it can be a bit confusing when people quote their results in terms of power spectrum. Typically you have to go and you know, find out what definition they're using. So for example, the one that's often used, let me just write it down. But the important thing is really the variance. So often, people define P of K to be just given by this mod chi squared, or whatever the expansion happens to be for the field you're looking at. In that case, this would be equal to 2 pi squared over K cubed delta phi squared, delta sub phi squared of K. So often the power spectrum, definition of the power spectrum means is such that you have K dependence even for a scale invariant spectrum. So this is something you have to watch out for. So at first, this looks very promising. We have just a simple scalar field in a steep potential, and it gives the scale invariant spectrum of perturbations. It's really quite, in a sense, it's a bit surprising. So in Neil Truro's lecture, I think he gave a symmetry argument for why you would actually expect this to be true. But I think this is the kind of argument that you find after doing the calculation. I mean, it's a nice way to see afterwards why this is the result you could have expected. But I'm not sure if this is something that anyone would have just guessed like that. Now, so this is nice because this is very close to what's observed for the curvature perturbation is something that's a very nearly scale invariant spectrum. Of course, here we just calculated the spectrum in a scalar field. We haven't related it to an observable yet. The real observable is the curvature perturbation. So what we need to know is does this imply that the curvature perturbation also obtains a scale invariant spectrum? So we have to relate this to the curvature perturbation. Which is often denoted by zeta. That's the notation I'm going to use. And just to give you an indication of what we're aiming for, so the WMAP observations are usually quoted in terms of the curvature perturbation zeta. And sort of current limits at 2 sigma confidence level would be that the variance of this of the curvature perturbation at the reference scale of 0.002 inverse megaparsecs is given by about 2.4 plus or minus 0.2 times 10 to the minus 9. This is the variance, so this corresponds to the perturbation squared, so the amplitude of the perturbation would be roughly the square root of this, and that's why people often say that, you know, the amplitude of primordial perturbations is about 10 to the minus 5. And the spectral index for the curvature perturbation is measured to be roughly 0.96 plus or minus 0.03 or something like that. So close to 1, but slightly below. So this is what we want to actually. This is what we want to explain. Now it turns out that going from this simple scalar field to the curvature perturbation is not that trivial, and there's no simple. The problem is, once we include gravity, we need to solve the equations again from the start, because you have different gauges, and it's not clear how to just relate a calculation which ignored gravity. It's not so easy to just translate that result into a calculation which includes gravity. So, as it turns out, we have to do the calculation properly. The reason for doing the limit without gravity is that it's pretty straightforward to do, and it has the same. All these calculations of cosmological perturbations work in roughly the same manner, even when gravity is included. There's just certain details become more complicated. Well, and the main thing that's more complicated is the starting point, so you even arrive at the equation that you want to solve, because you need to know, you need to fix the gauge and so on. This is not. Not completely trivial. Okay, so now let's do the calculation with gravity. So we still write the phi as phi bar plus a perturbation. And well, I'm just going to briefly sketch how it goes, but I don't have time to derive the perturbed Einstein equations in any detail. So I'll have to refer you to a paper to look at that. The idea is that the metric can be expanded in the ADM formalism. So this is stands for Arnowitz, Desner, and Misner. You write the space-time as a decomposition into time and space, right? So you reintroduce this space and time splitting. So you write it as minus n squared dt squared plus h sub ij dxi plus ni dt dxj plus nj dt. Okay, this is usually called the lapse function. This is usually called a shift function. You can express any metric in this way. Now, it turns out that, so you can take this as a starting point, and from this one can quite easily derive the equations of motion, the perturbed equations of motion. It's just slightly lengthy. It's not particularly difficult, it's just lengthy. So you should look at this paper. There's a paper by Maldacena that describes this very precisely. So this is Astro PH 02 10603. Okay. So you should read section 2 of that paper, which really does this in a short space, but very, very precisely. And then the most, since what we want to calculate is the curvature perturbation zeta, it turns out there is one specific gauge that's really most convenient for just calculating zeta, and this is actually called the zeta gauge. And in this gauge, you use your gauge choice to actually set the perturbations of the scalar field to zero, and you just want to calculate metric perturbations. And then the different equations of motion relate all these perturbations to all different perturbations to each other. So you write hij as a squared of t, just the standard Freeman-Robertson-Walker factor, and then 1 plus 2 zeta t and x delta ij. Okay, so now you can see why it's called a curvature perturbation, because zeta just corresponds to a small perturbation in the scale factor of the universe, but a local perturbation of the scale factor. That means that locally the curvature will be slightly different when zeta is non-zero. And it turns out that this is the quantity that translates most directly into the temperature fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. So this is what's measured, really. Well, the lapse and shift, it turns out that in this formalism, they act as like Lagrange multipliers, and they give you constraint equations, which actually, and those are the equations that relate zeta to the other perturbations. So, for example, if you don't have to take this particular gauge here, but in any gauge you choose, all the different perturbations you have are always related to one perturbation via these equations that arise from the lapse and shift Lagrange multipliers. Well, this is a gauge choice here. And this is, obviously, this will be a convenient one because, oh, you mean, well, we're looking at scalar perturbations. So if you take a standard, if you take any random off-diagonal perturbation, this is really a tensor perturbation, not a scalar perturbation. And so actually this is a tensor perturbation, and this corresponds to gravitational waves then that you're producing. In fact, one of the problem sets, the last of the problems, deals with this, with what happens when you look at those perturbations. So here, At the moment, I'm just interested in scalar perturbations.
But that means scalars, vectors, and tensor perturbations. No. You just select.
Yeah, you could. You would write plus. Capital H I J here.
Okay.
And then, but with the constraint that you know that you would keep this. You know, you would have to make sure that what you're looking at is really a tensor. So this ensures that it's not a vector, and this ensures that you're getting rid of the scalar part too. So that what you're left with is just a tensor perturbation. That's what you would, so in general, you would look at this. It turns out vector perturbations decay very quickly, so they're not very interesting. The scalar and the tensor perturbations are the most interesting ones. But here, at the moment, I'm just looking at the scalar perturbations. So for the moment, actually, you can just ignore this if you want. And the important thing is that the effective action you get for zeta is just epsilon g mu nu d mu zeta d nu zeta. Now, in we're going to look at perturbations around this background scaling solution. And this scaling solution, I can take epsilon to be constant. This can also be generalized, and I'm going to do that also later on. But for now, keep epsilon constant. In that case, it's very easy to derive the equation of motion for zeta. And in fact, again, just doing the Fourier, going to Fourier space, we get that zeta sub k double dot plus 3h zeta k dot plus k squared over a squared zeta equals to 0. Epsilon is the related to the equation of state 3/2 1 plus w, and in terms of the it's equal to, in the single field case, it's equal to c squared over 2 if the potential v goes like minus e to the minus c phi, this c. Okay, so epsilon is, you can call it the fast roll parameter. In inflation, you have a slow roll parameter, which is the same epsilon, but epsilon is very small. Here, epsilon is very large. Typically, this is of order 100 or so. Well, it's gonna turn out that way. Right. So h here is the Hubble parameter. That's how gravity enters this equation explicitly. Now it's very convenient to go to use conformal time instead of ordinary time. So if we define conformal time tau, define it by dt equals a d tau. That means that if you just have a standard Friedman, Robertson, Walker line element, normally you would have minus dt squared plus a squared dx squared. Now this means that you have an overall scale factor. That's why it's called conformal time, because it makes this metric explicitly look conformally invariant. And if we denote derivatives with respect to tau by primes, then this equation turns into zeta double prime plus 2 a prime over a zeta prime plus k squared zeta equals 0.
We've gone from a flat space case in which we had a d squared v d phi squared type term. And then we go to this case where we're putting in gravity and we see that gravity appears in the 3h curvature term.
Yes.
But
oh, the potential term.
Well, it turns, so this is, yeah, you're right, this is surprising. But it turns out that once you include metric perturbations, the effect is sort of to cancel out the potential effectively. In this case, that's also something completely unanticipated. So the way the potential enters is only through the way that it determines the evolution of the scale factor and therefore gravity. But it turns out it doesn't appear explicitly anymore. But of course, once gravity is included, everything is directly connected to everything else. So it is automatically, it is implicitly included. So you can do a convenient, there's a convenient field redefinition just to write y as a zeta over the square root of minus k tau and to call x equals minus k tau. And if you do this and you work through, you plug this into the equation, and this is also something you can verify by doing one of the problems in the problem set, then you arrive at the standard Bessel equation. X squared d2y by dx squared plus x dy by dx plus x squared minus alpha squared y equals 0. And this is the equation that I included this on the handout that I gave you last time. When you work with cosmological perturbations, it turns out you always end up getting this equation. And this equation is solved in terms of, you can conveniently solve it in terms of Hankel functions. You have lots of functions which solve this equation. They're all related to each other. But it turns out that in this case, the most convenient ones are the so-called Hankel functions. And I listed their properties on the handout, so you can. This is something that you should. That is always. That's well. It's convenient to keep close by. Here, alpha is given by a double prime over a tau squared plus a quarter square root of this. Again, this is something you're going to be able to verify in one of the problems. And this is roughly equal to a half, since a is roughly constant. So this first term is, to a first approximation, this term is 0. So this is just, alpha is just a half. And this alpha is actually what's called the sort of the index of the Hankel functions. Right? So the solutions would be that y would be proportional to either the first or the second of the Hankel functions with index 1/2 of x. So now you have to use the sort of the asymptotic properties of the Hunker functions that I also listed. And again, we want the same thing. We want to impose boundary conditions. So we want that at early times, so as t goes to minus infinity, we want zeta to approach, again, the sort of Minkowski, the standard Minkowski vacuum. And so this, if you do this, it's straightforward to find out that zeta should be given by approximately by the square root of minus tau over a times h 1/2 minus k tau h 1. I'm not putting in factors of 2 right now, because it turns out that this is at this point it's not important. Then we're interested in what we get at late times, because that's what's related to what we observe in the CMB. So we take this solution, and we calculate the variance, zeta squared. So it's given by d3k, 2 pi cubed, minus tau, over a squared, and then you have to plug in the Hunker function squared. And you can go through this, and you find that the result is proportional to dk over k, k squared. And this indicates that the spectral index should be roughly 3. So this is this is a blue spectrum. What's called a blue spectrum, because there's more power for higher values of k corresponding to smaller scales. If ns is less than 1, it's usually called a red spectrum. And so this clearly disagrees with observations. So it turns out that this nice scale invariant spectrum we had in the scalar field, in fact, didn't get transferred at all to the curvature perturbation. I think this was a surprise to many people when this was found out. But it means that this standard single field case is just not just ruled out by observations. Pretty much run out of time. So, in fact, there is a way to understand this. I'll just sketch it very roughly. Normally there's two types of perturbations. You can have time delay perturbations and curvature perturbations. So a time delay perturbation would be sort of a little perturbation which changes the time to or from the Big Bang. And the curvature perturbation corresponds to a local rescaling. And so what happened here is that the scalar field perturbation, so delta phi, the scalar field was given as something like 1 over t. In any case, delta phi, if you have the potential, a little perturbation in phi means that you're slightly further up or further down in the potential. That means that actually the time it will take you to reach the Big Bang will be slightly more, slightly less. So this perturbation in delta phi turned out to be a time delay perturbation. And in a contracting universe, this is a growing mode perturbation. On the other hand, the curvature perturbation, which is what zeta corresponds to, this is just a local rescaling of space. And it turns out that in a contracting universe, that's actually a decaying mode. Okay, so zeta is rather a local spatial rescaling. And so these two modes actually don't have anything to do with each other a priori. They're just different types of perturbations. And so it turns out that actually in an expanding universe, it's the other way around. This, the curvature perturbation is the growing mode, and the time delay is the decaying mode. Now, so what this means, well, what it means is that either something has to happen which will mix these two modes into each other. So in fact, there's sort of two possibilities, right? One is that we get some mode mixing. There are models of how this could happen. In the standard four-dimensional effective field theory, this cannot happen. But if you have a higher dimensional framework, it turns out that close to the Big Bang, it can happen that these two modes get mixed into each other. I'm not going to talk about this here, because this is a possibility, but this is not something that is extremely well understood. The second thing is that it turns out we've actually been a bit over restrictive here in considering just one scalar field, because almost all models of where you try to embed this in a more fundamental theory give you more than one scalar field. And in fact, it's very natural to have two scalar fields, for example. I'll show this in more detail. It turns out once you have two scalar fields, the story changes in such a way that the relative fluctuation between these two scalar fields picks up a scale invariant spectrum, but is also a growing mode, and in fact is a source for the curvature perturbation. In the next lecture, I'll show this in detail. And then, in fact, you will end up, and that way you can end up getting a scale invariant spectrum for zeta. Right, so the second is what's called the entropic mechanism. Okay, I think, are we going to have a short break or? Yeah. Okay. Let's have a break.